Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning, and this is Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. I'm your host, Paula Thompson, and with me is my dear friend and co-host, Andre Rodatis. Hi, Andre.
Good morning. How are you, Paula?
I'm great. I'm glad to hear your voice this morning.
Oh, I'm glad to hear yours, too. Yeah.
We are having a blizzard in Colorado right now, so...
Are you kidding me?
No, as the saying goes, in the Denver area anyway, it's still and clear, still snowing and clear up to your butt. So, but
springtime in the Rockies is another thing
you
hear.
Yeah, right. And we need the moisture that bad, so I'm not complaining. I'm glad to see the snow, and it's really a blessing. So. How's the weather where you are? Is it pretty cold still, or is it starting to get warm?
Spring is coming around, which means it's not feeling completely like winter around here.
Good.
It's probably just below freezing right now, and we've had intermittent snowfall last night. The wind is blowing, but hey, you know, just below freezing that's almost above freezing.
Well, welcome to springtime, everyone.
Yeah,
happy,
that's right.
Happy spring. We're doing the second one in a series of shows on the most, well, I should say one of the most intriguing papers in the Urantia book. It's a paper called Government on a Neighboring Planet. And, you know, the beginning of the paper, they give us this wonderful disclaimer where they tell us they've given this paper to us, which is another word for a chapter, obviously, in the Urantia book. There's 196 of them, and this one is paper 72. They've given us this paper by special permission, and they tell us that this planet is similar to our world in many ways, and it is evolving similar in many ways, and they wanted to give us this information, which is, they don't ordinarily reveal the information about one planet or the affairs of one planet to another planet, but they wanted to tell us about it because I get the feeling that they think that these guys have been able to figure out some things that we haven't been able to figure out, and I always have had the sense that they wanted to help us with this information in this paper. So I wasn't here for the first show on this paper, which you did a couple weeks ago. I was in Chicago for a media training session. And so I know you had several callers, and you guys went over the information, and it was a very good show, I heard. But this week you have some you want to take us a little bit further into the paper. What do you have in mind, Andre? Do you want to kind of flesh it out a little bit?
Sure. What we hope to do this week, you know, since we'd covered the first few sections last week, we went through section by section is what we ended up doing. And although I can't claim that we read everything in all three sections, we did read most of them and had considerable discussion about you know, the first three sections of the paper. And, you know, just to recap, what that did was it set up some of the history of what they were telling us about this this continental nation, which is section one, which is to say that on this planet of about 11 continents, one of the continents about the size of Australia that has about 140 million people at that time, meaning about 85 years ago, considering that this was coming in the Arantia book, which was indicted in 1934-1935, so closer to 80 years ago. I guess I should get better with my math. I could be even more precise, couldn't I?
You could be a math teacher.
78 or 79, yes. Show that I'm better even than estimating.
So they kind of spell out the geography of this continent. It's not about the entire world. We should make clear it's about one nation on this particular world that is a strife-torn world, not unlike our own.
Right.
And this particular nation has some good geographic protections built in that allows it to enjoy the ability to evolve pretty much unmolested. And so then they go from there. You say they had 100, 140 million at that time. So they
right.
give you some
and
geography.
We don't know what the population of the entire planet is. We don't know very much else, but 140 million is pretty close to what the population in the United States was around that time. In fact, I might take the time a little bit later just to go ahead and look it up, but we are at 310 million today,
wow.
or actually closer to 315 million now. We just crossed 310 a couple of years ago.
So we've more than doubled.
In the United States, and Canada to the north is 34 million, you know, just one-ninth that population
wow.
of the United States. The second largest country in the world, just to the north of the United States, the fourth largest country in the world, those two countries respectively have populations that are much, much lower than their surface area in comparison. China, the third largest country in the world, has the largest population at 1.3 billion people, and the second most populous country is India with 1.1 billion people. So we're far, far behind that in terms of
thank goodness
population, and as a result, we enjoy a relatively high standard of living as a result of that. Not that that is entirely, absolutely correlated all throughout the earth, but Singapore being an obvious exception to that, and you know, some other
mm-hmm.
things, but
mm-hmm.
without drifting off onto that, you get the idea.
Right.
You know,
and China's
Australia,
not doing too bad. Right. But
go Australia
ahead.
May have a population has a population considerably lower than the land man ratio of that continent, which apparently had a lot more moisture, had an arid western quarter compared to what Australia Australia has an arid three quarters or more, you know, in to the west of the eastern part of the continent, and that's probably exaggerating a little bit. It gets arid pretty quick once you get west of Sydney and Canberra and some of the southern parts of Australia. That central and western part of Australia is pretty, pretty arid. This continent, on the other hand, is described as having very advantageous central mountains, which receive rain about 8 months of the year, which means that there's a lot of water available, and in fact, just like California is able to make a lot of use, some might say gets to overuse, the water coming out of the Rockies, just like California gets to do that in order to irrigate the San Joaquin Valley, the arid western quarter of the continent is able to be irrigated in that same way. So basically, this country has a level of technology that would have been commensurate with the United States at that time or slightly ahead, and was able to make use of it in such a way that basically they were able to make use of most of the land. And that's pretty advantageous when you can use most of the land that you have available, and it's all surrounded by ocean. As we know in North America, that is a tremendous advantage in terms of not having wars on your borders raging year after year, every decade or so.
If you can protect the oceans around the continent, then you're pretty safe, and that's what I was meaning by a geographic advantage, and not unlike Australia also, and Great Britain is similar in that way.
So that was one feature that was being presented. Not that this was, you know, trying to be a revelation of this continent just to North America either. Mm-hmm. Simply presenting its features to us, which is something that we ought to be sensitive to. Although one thing to be noticed is that this island nation, we also learned, has a threefold separation of powers, which is similar to one of the governments on the face of Urantia, and that is the United States, which also, in its constitution, decided to have a threefold separation of powers, very different from the kinds of governments that you mostly see on the face of this planet, which are in the main parliamentary governments which combine the power of the executive and the legislature together in the form of the chief, the head of the legislators, which would be, to draw an analogy, you can't do this completely, but to say that the Speaker of the House in the Congress would also be, was the Speaker of the House elected because his party or her party was in power, also de facto becomes the Prime Minister. And that's the nature of a parliamentary system. Well, the United States doesn't do that. It separately elects its chief executive and calls that chief executive a president, and has a sitting vice president and all of that. And that...
Right.
is a way of separating the power of the executive, which essentially enforces the laws of the land and executes the laws of the land, from the legislature, which makes the laws of the land. Mm-hmm. And while that is not as efficient in terms of getting all laws enacted and getting there to be laws to be enacted, without being challenged a little bit more, because of the veto power of the president, it, what it does do is it provides a check and balance on that power. Something that, for instance, if you looked at Canada today as an example, you know, Canada, a very democratic country, is in a situation right now where the Prime Minister of Canada, because and his party, is able to, because they hold a majority of the seats in the government, is able to withstand any call for an election for the next 4 years, 5 years in total, and essentially can withstand any challenge to any of the laws that they put on the books, to any budget that they pass, to anything. In other words, they can, they may have to discuss things, but barely. Bottom line is the budget that was just put on the table last week, for example, will be discussed, will be talked about in the media. The opposition will, you know, rip it to shreds, and you know, the party in power will talk about its good points. But in the end of the day, because the Canadian people elected a majority government, that majority government can pass it no matter what. There will be, unless there's dissent within the party, which is not likely, that will pass, and that is true for every law that the conservatives, in this case, that party in power, put forward. And that would
now
be true for any party in power.
Do you think this is similar to government on a neighboring planet?
No, that's exactly what we're being told in the second section, is that... for instance, in the third paragraph in the section, the federal government embraces three coordinated divisions, executive,
right,
legislative, and judicial. And it does indicate that these are three separately held parts of the government. The judiciary, of course, in Canada is separate as well. The Supreme Court can challenge various laws, and does, and from time to time that does actually get the government that's sitting in power to have to reconsider some of what it's doing, but not all that often. And in the same way, though, in the United States, that judiciary can reinterpret a law or interpret a law in such a way that it cannot be enforced the way it was, or cannot be enacted the way it had been, or can be declared as completely unconstitutional and taken off the books. So all of that is significant. And this government on a neighboring planet is set up that way. It's set up with a judiciary that can challenge what's in the legislature, and a legislature that can challenge the executive, and the executive can challenge the legislature. But you get the sense, from having seen how what they reveal about this continental nation, is that whereas maybe some years back in their history they may have had more of those kinds of down and dirty political fights, they have gotten into more of a cooperative mode. They understand,
right,
that they're sort of all on the same team.
Well, yeah,
and that they ought
to
function that way.
Some of the things we're going to be talking about kind of illustrate just exactly how they've been able to do that. And I want to. We have a caller. Should I put our caller on?
Please do.
It might be somebody
from before.
Okay, great. Area code 505. You're with us on the Cosmic Citizen. Government on a neighboring planet.
Oh, I know who this is.
Good morning, Paula.
Good morning,
hi,
Charles.
It's Charles. So good to hear from you.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for joining us, Charles Olivier.
My pleasure.
Yes,
go ahead.
You've been listening. Did you have any comments about what we've said so far?
No,
we're
not
just doing
as much.
an overview.
It's inaccurate. I think person speaking gave an accurate overview of the U.S. government, our Democratic Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree that it's in many respects, important respects, close to the continental nation on our neighboring planet. But I had was thinking as I was listening, if I had to ask them a question, that is the leadership or somebody who's familiar with that government in that nation, the question would be this. Well, first of all, the premise of the question. In the American political philosophy, God is the source of our rights, not the government. And our civil and human rights directly come from God. It's stated explicitly, in the Declaration of Independence. And government is permitted to exist to protect, advance, otherwise to safeguard those rights. Very different from the European approach, which God gave the king power and the king
mm-hmm.
granted rights. And I wonder, the question I would have for something perhaps to speculate on is, in their political charter, do they cite the divine as the source of their rights, as we do?
Hmm.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Yeah,
and they don't address that in the paper.
No, so I've tried to infer it, and it could be. There's not enough evidence to go one way or the other, but it seems to be. But they also seem to emphasize, they tie it very closely to duty and the responsibilities
mm-hmm.
of duty. For instance,
yes.
They practice capital punishment. They do
right.
what we would not do. They will execute political leaders who betray their public trust, which would be a shocking...
Yep.
If someone recommended in the House of Representatives or introduced in the Senate a bill to that effect, or in one of the state legislatures, that would probably shock a lot of people.
Well, and you know, we simply wouldn't do it. I mean, we try more to find a way to brush it under the rug and pretend like it didn't happen than to call it out and call it what it is, and even make, you know, the betrayal of public trust has just seemed like par for the course. In a way, by
uh-huh.
us, but not on the neighboring planet. The neighboring planet, they take that very seriously. That's akin to treason.
Yeah,
yes.
Well,
I bring it up because it calls into question our moral reasoning and
mm-hmm.
theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And the contrast, I think, is worth studying and discussing.
I think you're right there, Charles. And again, this is Andre. When we look at their basis, and we're given some of the stages that happen in government, and one of the places, one of the papers just earlier on, it indicates in the Urantia book that today we find that the power in government, paraphrasing very loosely here, is held generally by businessmen and lawyers, and someday the next stage will be to put it in the hands of the scientists and teachers.
Mm-hmm.
After that, even into the hands of philosophers, and by that they mean more than just academics. They mean people that are advocating living philosophy, an art of living, and
mm-hmm.
all of the implications of that.
And really thinking about that stuff.
Exactly. So when I look at government on a neighboring planet, what I see here is that it's not just in the hands of lawyers and business people. It really does have a scientific feel to it. It feels like they have learned things in sociology and psychology which are so important to them, almost as laws, and that they almost consider sociology and psychology, my read would be, almost as a hard science, and take it seriously and apply it to things. For example, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that no home site is allowed to be less than 50,000 square feet. There's no family, no families that are allowed to live more than one under one roof, and there are very, very strict rules as to parenting and so on and so forth. What would your thinking be on that, Charles?
Well, a couple of ideas. First of all, that you're right, Andre. They do seem to, in their moral and political value system, stress merit as the basis, not class,
mm-hmm.
which is how we have done it historically. In the 17th century, in the English colonies, and the 18th century, the people that had power were pastors. There was a mm-hmm. religious basis and farmers. Mm-hmm. The 19th century was predominantly, in many levels, certainly in state and local levels, farmers and some lawyers. And we've shifted, as you said, to people of a law background and a corporate background. And I think your projection resonates with Plato's Republic and the anticipation of the ideal government being based on being run by thinkers, genuine thinkers,
mm-hmm.
who know how to do, how to act. But the underlying in the continental nation, they seem to be much more advanced in this regard than we are. In that
mm-hmm.
It's not class based, these different socioeconomic classes, but rather meritoriously based. And I would say they probably have benefited from the totality of their national experience the last 200 years, a good deal more than we have. There are in the late 19th century in this country, there were initiatives that were based on merit. The civil service system, which was a hot-button issue, as we would say today, in the 1870s and 80s, especially in the 1880s. Was considered the proper basis for service, at least in the bureaucracies. But it didn't really seem that idea, and civil services is ideally based on merit, that idea of merit didn't seem to eventuate to politicians themselves. But it does appear to have happened here. I can't discern any particular class basis for electability. And other than merit, it's not class-based, it's meritoriously based. And I think the wisdom in that is very deep.
Mm-hmm. Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Because it really is about right motivations. And, the public trust, to serve in the public trust, or to serve for the common welfare, is, and the Urantia book reiterates this many times, is the highest honor and privilege of any citizen, which would
mm-hmm.
indicate why it would be, you know, such a grave matter to betray that trust. It's interesting that we don't seem to think that it's such a grave matter. but then again, you know, we have to evolve somewhat to that point. And I think they really make that point very well about this this country, this nation on another planet. And I know it touches a little bit, and maybe you said it earlier on the last show, Andre, but the makeup, the racial makeup of these people, can you touch on that a little bit? Because I think that's interesting as well.
Well, there was something very interesting about it, and again, this is all speculation. I'm trying to understate that a little bit, but it was interesting to me. They say it's people are a mixed race, predominantly blue and yellow, having a slightly
uh-huh.
greater proportion of violet than the so-called white race of Urantia. These different races are not yet fully blended, but they fraternize and socialize very acceptably. The average length of life on this planet is now 90 years, 15% higher than that of the rest of the people on the planet. Now, what's interesting about that to me is when they talk in terms of racial composition about the rest of the planet. Elsewhere in the book, they refer to Japan as being one of the more balanced composition of blue and yellow race that is on our planet, although without the violet, at least without a very large degree of violet. Another place where they talk about blue and yellow being together is in the Near East, and but there's a greater admixture of the Nautite blood, which I won't go into. It sort of would possibly take us off track for the course of the show, but that would add another dimension, I think, to that people. What was interesting to me about that was when you look at Japanese society, there are many elements of the society which look to try to bring about order and creativity and social harmony, or at least, let's say, a certain amount of social order, similar to what you see or could feel from this paper if you're thinking about it. But you also have that element of invention that America and Europe had for the last couple of centuries. So it's interesting to look at that and just envisioning these people. I'm kind of envisioning sort of people a lot like the Japanese, having more mixed characteristics, and we go into that later. I'd rather not go down that road completely, but it's a very interesting thing to note the similarities in the value for social order that's being presented in both these populations, and the emphasis on creativity as well that is there in Japan as well today.
Well, let me just touch on why I find this fascinating, if you guys will indulge me for a minute. I find interesting characteristics in the races, and I'm impressed by, there's a section in the Urantia book about the later Chinese civilization, and because I adopted a child from China, I went and reread a lot of what the Urantia book has to say about the yellow race. And one of the things that intrigued me in this blending of the blue and the yellow, because it seems to me in some ways they're almost exactly opposite in characteristics in some ways. You have the adventurous blue man and the pretty stable yellow race. And it says that the mechanical and religious developments of the white races have been of a high order, but they have never excelled the Chinese in family loyalty, group ethics, or personal morality. I just find that much of what we read in Government on a Neighboring Planet has to do with some of those characteristics: family loyalty, group ethics, and personal morality. Mm-hmm. And I think that blending, that particular blending, that the yellow race maybe brings a lot of that in. And I've also thought, I can see how they lend themselves more to communal living, because that's really who they are. That's kind of what they hold. And one thing that strikes me about Government on a Neighboring Planet is there are aspects of it that are decidedly socialist. And that might, raise some hackles to some people, especially in the political climate that we're in right now in the United States. But there obviously are some values to that,
well,
especially
I'll be very
when it
interested.
Comes to these things.
Yeah, I'll be very interested in some of Charles' take on this as well. But it's been interesting for me to look at this, because it seems to me that they've, while it's clear that they've evolved out of very similar kind of political spectrum aspects, they've learned to apply the best of those aspects to the right place. For instance, they say that local government tends to be
yes.
a little more paternalistic and socialistic,
mm-hmm.
whereas
mm-hmm.
the federal levels of government tend to value, they don't say it quite as individuality, but they are a lot more laissez-faire and leaving people up to their on their own recognizance. So on the other hand, they very much they have a very strong hand on the home, making sure that everyone
mm-hmm.
receives good, strong parental education. They have a very strong hand on education itself, from cradle to grave, and they even have this one interesting telling note here, which is on the fourth last paragraph of section 3. That would be section 3, paragraph 6. They indicate, until 20 years ago, the spiritual teachers comparable to your rancher pastors who visit each family periodically to examine the children to ascertain if they have been properly instructed by their parents, were under governmental supervision. That's interesting. That almost speaks to something where religion and state were somewhat commingled, the way you might imagine in some European nations in the past. These spiritual advisors and examiners are now under the direction of the newly created Foundation of Spiritual Progress, an institution supported by voluntary contributions. That would almost indicate something that they've decided to try to make a little more autonomous, separation of church and state a little bit more. Then they indicate possibly this institution may not further evolve until after the arrival of a Paradise Magisterial Son, until they receive a revelation, in other words. I'm curious what either one of you think about that as part of their culture. And I know that Charles was alluding to that in the form of his question a little bit earlier about what we thought about whether God was at the center of this civilization or not. So what do you think based on that quote?
Charles? Go ahead, Charles.
I also wanted to comment on your racial statement, your comments on race, remarks on race earlier.
Go ahead.
But you evolved. I like to bring in again a historical perspective, since we often compare and contrast the United States to this nation, and I think with some justification. On the basis of a book, the Rancher book. In the 17th century and 18th century, or at least the early part of the 18th century, particularly in New England, it was customary for local pastors, again, local culture, the feature of local culture, local pastors to visit homes to make sure that children were being properly tutored in regard to prayer and scripture. So that was embedded in the fabric of society at that time, colonial society. The Declaration of Independence mentions God four times in various causalities, and that's kind of an outgrowth of that type of religious consciousness. But then, curiously, we gradually, very slowly, separated church and state in different ways. And although the Bill of Rights, of course, makes two points about religion, our government may not interfere with religion. I mean, not favor religion, makes both points. In the 20th century, that became, the wall of separation was considerably greater. That was not the case early in our history. They
mm-hmm.
seem to be going in that direction now, where we had been earlier, at least the Puritan culture norms required this kind of supervision at one time. And it's interesting to me that this continental nation is going in that kind of direction. It's redefining who is responsible for what to whom in regard to what we might term religious or spiritual education. I'm not sure what to make of that. It's an enormous theme, and it's a stupendous theme. I don't know quite what to make of the implications either here or there. But they do, and it's given to us. It's part of the revelation. So I presume it's we're intended to perhaps rethink that as a society someday, to reconsider in what form religion may be, may have more of an overview, more active overview, without interfering with religious freedom, religious liberty. That would be, for us, that would be a tricky distinction to make under law and in practice and custom and norms.
Mm-hmm. I almost see this as a contrast, you know, between, you know, when since we are so liberty focused in the United States, that. And by that I mean individual liberties and individual rights focused. That is sort of the first priority in terms of all the reasoning. And so there's been a pendular swing that makes sure that, you know, religious freedom is there no matter what. Therefore, the government having any hand with anything like a foundation for spiritual progress would be regarded as meddling, whereas this society seems to have such a value on social control and order, and maybe not control as much as order, that they've had this hand guiding that institution, and their pendulum is swinging not quite so far, and perhaps they have, this is a much slower individual, and we're seeing the pendulum swing very, very slowly toward the, you know, in the form of this foundation of spiritual progress. Just speculation on my part.
Well, I think it's important. Oh, go ahead, please, Paul.
Well, I was just going to ask, don't they say that religious education is exclusively the responsibility of the home, the parents? Which would say to me that they do very much respect religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to empower the home to be the ones to teach that. So there's no governmental or institutional religion that's imposed on anybody if that's the case. It's really interesting, though, that they don't say a lot of about what the people in this nation actually believe.
Well, I think... This granting of authority to parents has to do with liberty, but I think it has less to do with that and more with duty. Their sense of duty is my impression.
Mm.
I'd like to try to connect that to their racial composition, if I may. Just
go ahead.
Sure. Or do either one of you want to say something else before I do?
Well, no, and I want to point out, I just brought that in because I think that is a factor in this particular national life and the way it's evolved. So, yeah, go ahead, Charles.
I think it certainly is. It's a very important factor as well. Going back to the fact that the composition of their population consists primarily of the yellow and blue races, I think your comments, Paula, earlier about the characteristics of both races are spot on. I would just paraphrase them here. The yellow race is known for its social capacities, its ability to organize, to produce networks, relationships, from a social, a group point of view. Not so much the individuals, but a group.
Mm-hmm.
The blue race,
exactly.
Of course, and the characteristics, general characteristics, seem to bear out both here and there. Blue race, of course, is known for action. It's a doing race. Indeed, I believe it reflects the deity, the infinite spirit, the god of action, in its deity origins. So if you combine the social function and the action function, what do you get? Well, without they have a high. We know from what they said they have a somewhat higher infusion of violet genes, the violet racial genes, the endemic racial genes. I think what resulted in this continental nation, which the other races and nations on their planet do not have enough of, is that it enabled them to balance the action impulse with the impulse of the social for stability, the stability aspect of the social capability of the yellow race with balancing with the action impulse of the blue race. And I suspect genetically that their gene pool, because the violet infusion has given them has enabled them to integrate them better, the social and action features, giving them more self-control, literally, genetically and then culturally, in both senses, and a greater social consciousness. And in their socialist aspects, they that's balanced with their profound sense of personal duty, personal individual duty and responsibility. They seem to put a great deal of emphasis on your obligations to society, what you're expected to do. Everybody works. They remember that statement in the book?
Right.
The blanket said, everybody works. No one doesn't
everybody.
Work. You're not allowed not to work.
Right.
Simply wouldn't be permitted. They must have a very strong sense of shame, therefore, and shame is a powerful. It's a form of ostracism, and it's a very ostracism is a very powerful form of enforcement. You can see it in Amish society; it works very well. Whereas in the United States, we have in the last 50 years diminished our sense of shame. These are the responsibilities, duties, obligations. They've gone in the opposite direction. And as a result, they have, and this is not the only reason, but they have less crime, less instability. There are they also use eugenic policies and other things. But I think they have a great deal more stability, both individually and collectively, partly as a direct result of the integrative nature, thanks to the violent infusion of their genes, their racial makeup, genetic racial makeup, and then which gives them the ability. That genetic foundation gives them the ability to be more organized, to be more controlled, self-controlled, to be controlled collectively and socially and politically and economically. And their laws reflect that. As I said earlier, they punish transgressions that are treated as treason, the equivalent of treason,
right.
for those in power.
Mm-hmm.
Not the powerless, but those in power. Are held to the highest standard, which makes a great deal of moral sense to me. As a teacher, for instance, I held myself to a much higher standard than my students.
Well, and that's
that
a Jesusonian teaching. Jesus said that. More is expected.
Yes, exactly.
Of the master.
I that's fair, that's just, that's proper.
Yes.
It's rational. It makes a great deal of sense. I think we could learn a lot from this society along those lines.
Oh, absolutely. And,
yeah.
You know, and the place that I guess I always get stuck as I read Government on a Neighboring Planet, which is obviously so full of practical wisdom, I would say, and next steps for you know, maybe our world. Maybe it's not just the United States, but maybe many governments that are existing now on our world could learn a great deal from this paper. And in fact, many people have sent this paper to various politicians hoping that they would, I think. But what I get stuck on often is, you know, how do we begin to get there from here? How do we begin to start valuing morality and group ethics and these very things that they've achieved?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an excellent question, Paula. I like what you said there with regard to, you know, applying. How do you apply these teachings? Clearly, there are various aspects of this paper that any particular nation or society might see more applicable or less applicable to their particular society. You know, for instance, 2 weeks ago we mentioned the idea that, you know, lobbying, you know, has evolved to such a place in U.S. society that some of the governmental developments where it appears that the lower house on government on a neighboring planet has evolved essentially to bring the lobbyists into the government. You know, that may be too strong, but you can see that kind of evolution possibly having taken place, that we now have a situation where money is unduly influencing politics in the United States and many other countries in the world, obviously, but quite obviously in the United States through lobbyists, which is essentially granting a super franchise to very many other kinds of political groups that have the money.
Have money.
What happens if you give them each, whether they have money or not, so long as they have the representation of their people, what happens if you give them a political seat, not a socioeconomic seat, but how do they put it a little bit earlier? One of the seats that is embracing the social, political, and philosophical groups not included in industry or the professions. If that's the case, well, that sounds a lot like, you know, getting what people are really passionate about and behind in terms of, you know, influencing the government and wanting them to represent them, having that actually be represented legitimately in the government. And that would obviously take away any kind of influence of money behind the scenes. That may not be part of their evolution. That may be projection of our circumstance onto them by me, and I'm certainly not trying to do that. But you can see how that kind of evolution would be one aspect that would fit current evolutionary trends in the United States. We clearly have to get a handle on that, or votes are going to become increasingly meaningless and increasingly less representative in the United States.
Well, and I think Charles brought up a wonderful point as well, and that is that unless they are willing to impose, unless lawmakers are willing to impose laws that regulate themselves and their own behavior, which it would be up to them to do, we can't force them. I mean, well, maybe we can, but I can't see any way that we can force our legislators to hold themselves to ethical behavior and moral behavior, and to create severe consequences for themselves if they don't. They would. It just seems to me like they would vote it down every time, and in that way they've been corrupted by lobbyists and other, you know, they've really become drunk in their own power, I think. But it would be a great step in the right direction if they could legislate some rules that held them accountable as well, and that made that created real penalties. They're seldom ever prosecuted for these kinds of behaviors. Yeah, they're drummed out, but I mean, it's not treated like a crime when in fact it really is. And yet they don't enact laws that would hold them accountable themselves. And I find that a problem. And the other thing that I think would be really, really helpful is certainly from my point of view as a woman, and the Arantia book says that women are moral standard bearers and the moral standard bearers of humanity and the spiritual leaders. And it's clear that, to me anyway, that some of the good old boys club have really held the moral standard bearers and the spiritual leaders out of the party, because they don't want anybody reminding them that something's not moral, or they don't want to be led spiritually. Just my point of view. But I think that if we did elevate to more equality, I think that's essential, that women have a stronger voice just because of that very reason, that we are the moral standard bearers and the spiritual leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that comes from I personally think that women become that way because we are the life carriers on the world. We bring life, we suffer to bring it, and then we nurture it, and it becomes so precious to us.
Hmm.
And I think that conditions our desire for life to be sustained. You know that great quote from the book, "Law is life itself and not the rules of its conduct."
Right,
if it upholds
right.
life and gives life and sustains life and honors life and creates life, abundant life, rich life, beautiful life.
Well,
so,
I think you have a point in women gaining greater and greater representation in political life. Certainly, that is going to be one aspect that is going to represent the society more evenly and is going to bring that very, very valuable perspective of women that it already has been changing, you know, our political institutions
yes.
quite a bit. You
and
know,
that
when
goes
when
slowly.
I think, and it does. I think this. I think you've given us a very good opportunity for a segue into what we were going to study today as well. And I'm going to give Charles an opportunity here to respond in just a moment as well. But the segue would be here that I think we underestimate the power that we all have. I mean, clearly, if you're educated to a certain level where you can see what institutions should be and what your society could be, you vote differently than if you have no idea and you just accept essentially what's coming across the plate that's being given to you. And I think there's a certain amount of we don't have necessarily our best people choosing to run because our best people know that the society is not necessarily going to vote for them. And so you've got a chicken and egg problem here that I think would begin to be solved were the society better educated in the manner that government on a neighboring planet is doing it, which is to say from cradle to grave, they're educating people into not only a book knowledge, quite far beyond that. They're giving some kind of experiential knowledge, even about political institutions, by having some of those things enacted. And I think this would be a great segue into launching into our reading of Section 4 here shortly. But I'd like to give Charles an opportunity to respond here, and I would like to ask him to then launch out on the reading of this. There's no accident, I'm sure, that since we announced that we were going to start with Section 4, Charles, a longtime servant and educator, servant of the educational system in the United States, I don't know whether it's 3 decades or 4 that you've been teaching, Charles, but certainly you're going to have something to say on Section 4.
I do, and I would. It's been in excess of 4 decades, mostly public high school.
Uh-huh.
And your observations, your comments, your passion, Paula, in regard to the role of women in society, again, I think is well taken. The strength of that, one of the great strengths of that Continental Nation is that the Adamic revelation was more effective there, genetically and culturally, it seems to me.
Mm.
To bring women in a meaningful way into the running of society on all levels is Adamic, and we don't have that as much. Our influence is I think hence one of the reasons for the book's future influence will be to reestablish the integrity of that, the necessity for that, for this Adamic valuing of the male-female, the yang and the yin.
It's so fundamental.
And the great duality, that duality was fractured here very seriously.
Yes.
Whereas there,
so
in that continental nation, it was more unified.
Mm-hmm.
No republic has, in this world has ever survived without sufficient virtue. The continental nation, I think, their political system is largely run successfully and is evolving intelligently because of virtue. The whole society, the emphasis on duty, responsibility, obligations is akin to cosmic citizenship as well, literally, actually. And you can't expect a society to evolve successfully without sufficient virtue. Look at how in the last 50 to 80 years we have depreciated virtue in many of our institutions, from schools to entertainment to government and many others. And particularly, I would say, in the last 40 to 50 years, especially the last 40 years, virtue has declined, has depreciated. And I think there's a great deal of fallout from that. And the Republic, the American Republic, necessarily has to suffer. Government has to suffer. Power, it's human nature to have power, to have a corrupting influence to a degree. But our problem is much greater than that. We don't treat the role of the positions of responsibility and power morally the way we ought to. We don't hold people to higher standards. Those in power generally don't hold themselves to a higher standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I attribute this to a lack of virtue, a relative lack of virtue. And this is a very difficult problem to reverse. It's a very, very difficult problem. But I think it would be helpful if the woman's influence, the way you were characterizing it, Paula, was promoted. And the hand that rocks the cradle is certainly capable to offer morally a leverage, effective, good leverage upon this society, upon European societies, Asiatic ones, worldwide. For example, the military dictatorships, the tendency toward military dictatorships in Latin America, the tendency in Africa,
mm-hmm.
and to some extent elsewhere in the early part of the 20th century in Europe and Asia, are male-driven. They're all male-driven. There's no question about that. They're gender designated in every respect. And I think part of the solution would be the Adamic solution, an Adamic ideal, which somehow in the future we must reinstate. If we don't, I don't know how we can expect things to evolve. And again, the hand that rocks the cradle would be an important part of the solution. Just a few thoughts.
Yes.
Yeah, and part of that Adenic solution that you might be that might be the subtext of what you're saying, Charles. Part of that is the fact of men looking at women as equals and women looking at men as equals equally. One not trying to lord it over the other, but both working in partnership in the. You know, the primary work of the society, which is the foundation of the home, fathers being as big a part of the home as the mothers, and both being equal members socially of society.
Yes.
And we've clearly seen a great evolution of that in terms of rights, but we certainly haven't seen the responsibilities commensurately evolving with that. We don't see rights and responsibilities evolving hand in hand, at least in the United States.
That's a good point, Andre.
Well, it's not looked at in the affirmative side. It should be viewed as a we. The biological and cultural dualities of men and women is so profound and so basic that its repercussions continue forever. I think it's on page 939. It's talked about how the male and female viewpoints will persist long after the mortal estate. It's that profound, and civilization in this in Urantia must either discover that or rediscover that. Whichever case it may be, it doesn't matter to whatever it's designated. I think what really matters is to look at this duality in the affirmative, positive light of it, that you have profound variations that are intended to be integrated, and it's the lack of the integrative behavior that's hurting us. We're not taking advantage of all of our resources. That duality is very rich, morally, mm-hmm. culturally, spiritually, emotionally, socially, and it could be very rich politically, economically as well. And our civilization is right now, a civilization on Earth, I think, has fallen very, very short on that. There are elements mm-hmm. of it, there are features of it, the right to vote, which in the democratic nations was granted on a national level in the 20th century. It took that long. We, you know, put that, just the right to vote for women, just put it in perspective, before that was considered legitimate. It's now become, it's universally recognized, more or less, as an essential. Not in every part of the world, but generally it is. And it took a long, long time for that to evolve, as an example. But that's a very narrow feature of it. It has its importance, but it's more the to look at, to use this, to view this duality, I think. And the continental nation, the neighboring planet, seems to do that, and it begins in the home life where fathering and mothering are combined. They're understood that you need fathering in addition to mothering, and mothering, that both are necessary. They're not equal in terms of the nature of them. I view equality as a moral and legal and spiritual precept. The rule of law fosters equality. Before God were mm-hmm. equal, but in terms of our nature, no. But that's instead of exploiting those differences should be integrated, and that duality should be blended in terms of action. And it's unfortunate that that men underestimate women, and I don't know about the other direction exactly what to say about that, but it has to be we have to take a more mature, philosophically, morally, more mature view of that before we're going to progress.
Yeah. Hey,
well,
equality is not sameness is part of what I hear in that. Elsewhere in the teachings it says, men's rights are not women's rights and women's rights are not men's rights. That ultimately they have their spheres of influence, and it's not trying to define those necessarily completely, but it is indicating that, for goodness sake, it isn't a field of competition for men and women to be competing in the same field. There's overlap, but they have different spheres of influence, and it should remain that way, or it should evolve back that way.
Well, the book makes an interesting generalization somewhere that men will forever be king of their domain and women will forever be queen of their domain.
Mm-hmm.
I see that duality again as the potential of that duality is fully integrative.
And I think also that the balance is created when voices are equally heard. And I think it's something you said earlier, Charles, or maybe Andre, you said it, that when we can come to the table as equals and honor each other's voice and give each other a way to speak and be heard, and really in Jesus's great discourse on law and sovereignty, and he essentially says that too, that when the world unites and when all the countries of the world surrender their sovereignty to God, really, alone to God, but especially to one great world government that represents all the people of the world, that will give every nation a voice and everybody a way to a right of redress of grievances, you know. And I think that's important. That equality is tied up in that everybody has a voice and a way to be heard, not just the rich and powerful, but even those who have no power have a right to be heard. And of course, you know, women and children have been pretty powerless on the world, but you know, I think the morality and the ethics of humanity is to say, you know, to cry out for the unfairness of that and to say we can no longer tolerate a world where some people are treated so badly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, we were just studying that section in study group the other night in the Jesus Papers, his discourses. During the Urmia lectures.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's a good correlation for this paper, really, because he's holding up an ideal that is, you know, obviously not a reality on this world yet either.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular nation is heading there, and they give us, you know, great examples of how they are heading in that direction.
And one of the ways they're doing it is by making sure that education is a keynote here. And why don't we launch into that, since that would be one of the ways that our society could actually be transformed, including under that parental education, which is going to be the way that the home life ultimately is going to be reformed. In any nation on this planet, is for people to gain greater wisdom and knowledge about the ins and outs of parenting and what would actually help children to grow into better, more mature, and more self-supporting human beings. So I threatened you, Charles, with asking you to read.
And you read so well.
Would you love to do that for us?
Yes, section 4, the educational system.
Yes.
Just reshuffling myself in my chair. The educational system of this nation is compulsory and coeducational in the pre-college schools that the student attends from the ages of 5 to 18. These schools are vastly different from those of your rancher. There are no classrooms. Only one study is pursued at a time, and after the first 3 years, all pupils become assistant teachers, instructing those below them. Books are used only to secure information that will assist in solving the problems arising in the school shops and on the school farms. Much of the furniture used on the continent and the many mechanical contrivances, this is a great age of invention and mechanization, are produced in these shops. Adjacent to each shop is a working library where the student may consult the necessary reference books. Agriculture and horticulture are also taught throughout the entire educational period on the extensive farms adjoining every local school. The feeble-minded are trained only in agriculture and animal husbandry and are committed for life to special custodial colonies where they are segregated by sex to prevent parenthood, which is denied all subnormals. These restrictive measures have been in operation for 75 years. The commitment decrees are handed down by the parental courts. Everyone takes 1 month's vacation each year. The pre-college schools are conducted for 9 months out of the year of 10, the vacation being spent with parents or friends in travel. This travel is a part of the adult education program and is continued throughout a lifetime, the funds for meeting such expenses being accumulated by the same methods as those employed in old age insurance. 1/4 of the school time is devoted to play, competitive athletics. Pupils progressing in these contests from the local to the state and regional and on to the national trials of skill and prowess. Likewise, the oratorial and musical contests, as well as those in science and philosophy, occupy the attention of students from the lower social divisions on up to the contests for national honors. The school government is a replica of the national government with its 3 correlated branches. The teaching staff functioning as a third or advisory legislative division. chief object of education in Wisconsin is to make every pupil a self-supporting citizen. Every child graduating from the pre-college school system at 18 is a skilled artisan. Then begins the study of books and the pursuit of special knowledge, either in the adult schools or in the colleges. When a brilliant student completes his work ahead of schedule, he is granted an award of time and means wherewith he may execute some pet project of his own devising. The entire educational system is designed to adequately train the individual.
And
there's a lot in here, but from an educational standpoint, that is a teaching standpoint, and curriculum and pedagogy, what impresses me, some of the highlights that really impress me, are, first of all, it's very holistic. It's not compartmentalized, as our system is. It's a holistic system. It values unity. And then it values, which allows for individuality, not uniformity, but unity. And in that, it's integrative, their integrative sense is manifested. And this mirrors the whole of their society. These values run throughout their entire society. So you can see the home life, you have married mothers and fathers working in tandem. That's a high value. It's a norm. And that kind of unity is then carried forward in the educational system, that this emphasis on holistic unity. But in view of all that, the individual is never lost sight of. And that's a cosmic value. It's a value of the universe. God cherishes each individual. And this reflects that. And all of that's very impressive. On another aspect, the way they use books, the way they use specialized knowledge, only in a technical sense, not the way we would approach it, expecting a great deal of very broad reading, which I think that one can make a good argument for. I've remains to be seen which has the advantage. But the way they do it is consistent with their holistic unity. And to study one thing at a time is I think educationally sound. It's very sound for the young. Although I think an argument can be made for more than one. But if you think about it, in our system it's reversed. Everybody's expected to have a major in college, so it's narrowed down. And the elementary and secondary school levels are meant to be generalized. Very broad, to give a broad display, comprehensive. When public high schools in the earlier part of the 20th century were evolving, the term comprehensive high school came into existence, and it was quite popular among teachers, administrators in the middle part of the century, particularly. They have a reverse of that, but they get very good results. They appear to get much better results than we do. And they don't talk about dropout rates and that type of thing. I suspect with the satisfying in each individual child's, or at least building a system that attempts to satisfy each individual child and is structured in that way so that theory and practice are unified, they probably have a very low dropout rate, just as they have a very low crime rate. I see all these things as interconnected.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, in fact, like you, Charles, I can hardly imagine, you know, how a citizen would be dropping out there and what the consequence of that would be. Both the social culture would make it extremely uncomfortable, would be one aspect, but that wouldn't be the main thing. It would be a matter of there would be so many cultural supports to make sure that there was success, including meeting the individual's needs. And that's underscored by the last paragraph there where, you know, when a brilliant student completes his work ahead of schedule, and I'm sure that's her work as well, he or she is granted an award of time and means wherewith they may execute some pet project of their own devising. I mean, can you imagine any system that didn't value an individual not allowing that? And of course, that even happens in more enlightened educational systems. In our system, a brilliant pupil can progress, but given the hands-on nature of that education, that student is getting some practical education. And imagine, leaving your education and being an accomplished metal worker or an accomplished carpenter, including, cabinetry or whatever else you were doing, or a stonemason, all of those kinds of things. That's just to take some rough artisanship, or not even rough artisanship, but just some general ones. That would make a huge difference in our society already, because as economies go through ups and downs, there are still generally a need for all of those skills to be employed to a greater or lesser extent.
Yes, we had some of this in terms of school reforms in the later 19th, but more in the early 20th century. It was called industrial arts. It was valued. It's not to the same extent. In their system, every student learns empirical skills, trade skills. We'd call them trade skills down here. They all know at least one trade, every single one of them. In that, you can't graduate without that. That's one of the requirements. And you do that for years, from in the very formative years. It must have it does have an enormous impact on those individuals, those young people on their planet. A prison reform idea once was that you had shops producing furniture, license plates, and that kind of thing. I mean, this society and some others have acknowledged Germans, I think, at one time at least acknowledged the merit of a school shop. Problem is, we didn't make it universal. We didn't see that it's a virtue for everyone. It's quite a spectacle to have to be a doctor, physician, for example, or a lawyer, and know nothing about cars, nothing at all, just to make a point, illustrate a point, or anything else about electricity or plumbing or carpentry, nothing. And I think those are examples of compartmentalization. The school shops, they make furniture, and it's not something done simply academically. There is an academic aspect to it, to these students. It has an economic value. It has a social value. The furniture produced, so it must come up to a certain standard, higher standard, not a lower standard, not a mediocre or mundane standard. There must be something. They must strive for some, for quality, for excellence, true excellence, genuine excellence. Is then appropriated by society, is used by society. So they have completely integrated the theoretical and the practical, the conceptual and the empirical. And that is educationally very well grounded. That's very sensible. It reminds me somewhat of John Dewey in the early 20th century empiricist philosophers. They seem to understand and value this kind of a point. In our society, in the mid to later 20th century, until computers replaced them, shop classes were generally relegated, and I taught high school for over 40 years in three states, back east and here in the southwest, and I'm sure my experience was typical in observing. I didn't teach shop class. I mean, I taught history, but I observed the whole working of the whole school. Shop classes were generally relegated to the lower class, mainly. It was unusual to see somebody in the upper middle class take a shop course. And that's the way it devolved, I would say devolved. And what the Continental Nation has achieved is they understand what the hand is for. And that an educational transformation, educational experience is not sufficient just to address the head. You have to deal with the hand. And they have not only done that, they have successfully synthesized the hand with the head and the head with the hand in both respect, in both directions. And I think, in my opinion, that particular dimension of their schooling is superior to ours.
I couldn't agree with you more.
I have to point out too that doesn't the Urantia call? It does actually in paper 66. It says, "Work with the soil is not a curse; rather, is it the highest blessing to all who are thus permitted to enjoy the most human of all human activities." And I can't help but notice that in the first paragraph you read, Charles, is agriculture and horticulture are also taught throughout the entire educational period on the extensive farms adjoining every local school. Then go back to that I just quoted, work with the soil is not a curse, rather is it the highest blessing to all who are thus permitted to enjoy the most human of all human activities. You know, this idea that we can create something beautiful, something functional, something meaningful with our hands fundamental to who we are.
In this country, Paula, horticulture was considered a progressive aspect of educational reform in the later 19th century and early 20th century. And I'm not sure, I don't know why it disappeared. Perhaps our suburban development, particularly suburban development, undermined all that. Many of the one-room schools and one- and two-room schools and some of the smaller regional schools in the countryside, and in some cases, some of the schools in cities, practice some form of horticulture. That was considered a necessary reform element, a necessary educational element.
Mm-hmm.
But it largely disappeared. I guess there are a variety of factors, possibly television, indirectly, certainly urbanization and suburbanization, the consumerism, particularly it began in the 1920s, in the modern way we understand it, really started in the 1920s or manifested in a big way first in the 1920s with radio and other kind of advertising.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but horticulture was valued. In this society, at least, I know the history of education in this country. I don't know in other countries as well. But in this country, we valued it and we lost it. And the continental nation has perpetuated much to their gain.
Right, and they've done it with some very simple techniques that are instilled in children from the very beginning, it seems. And this last paragraph of what you just read, it also really intrigues me because, it makes so much sense to me. And I can't help but imagine how much better off we would be if every child graduating in our nation was a skilled artisan. And then began the pursuit of higher education even from there. Not that was a low education by any means, but we already know that education in this nation is compulsory from cradle to the grave, as Andre said. And so then you begin and this idea that when a brilliant student completes their work ahead of schedule, they're granted the award of time, where they can execute some pet project of their own devising. You know, I experienced that in my art class, and throughout I always had one art class or another, and I always excelled in them. And I would finish the project ahead of time, and my teachers would invariably say, okay, you know, maybe there's a piece you'd like to create, one you have in mind, you have all of the materials here, go for it. You're done ahead of everybody else. So they didn't expect me to sit and twiddle my thumbs. So that's something that I have always appreciated, that they gave me leave to go ahead and do that. And we know from the life and teachings of Jesus that was true with him too in the in the synagogue school that he went to. So
yeah,
well, there's a dimension of social morality mm-hmm. to the requirement of every child becoming a skilled artisan. I remember a judge once said, and his remark became famous, as it did, I think it should, that if a boy fished a lot, enjoyed the art of fishing, he rarely had anyone before him who fished a great deal. So he made an association between the virtues that fishing teaches, patience, attention to detail, to the bigger picture, etc. And he saw a benefit to society through the social morality of that. I see that in this nation, this continental nation, in the requirement of a skilled artisan and then the reward of their brightest students in special projects. Mm-hmm. It isn't that we've never had these ideas in education. We have. In a high school I taught in for 28 years in Connecticut, one of the reforms they instituted in the last several years that I was there, which I supported, although I don't think it went far enough, was a senior project. And that had some popularity mm-hmm. in the 1990s, and a number of high schools instituted them. There's an element of that, but it was there are some of the elements of rewarding brighter students. The problem is, however, in at least the school that I taught in, it devolved somewhat to a more mundane level, that anything went. It lost sight of excellence to a certain
uh-huh.
degree. And I suspect these people do not, just the reverse. We must be careful to remember that excellence and equality have nothing in common. There, again, this reflects the balance, the integrative balance that they have achieved in the fabric of their society from top to bottom and bottom to top throughout their whole society. They have a sense of excellence as well as practicality.
Mm-hmm.
And those are different values. Those are different functions and values. And these people really understand the unity of what's practical or functional and what's of moral value and intellectual value. And they seem to have, once again, coordinated equality and excellence, which are usually, in your answer, they're enemies. They're basically enemies, equality and excellence. They certainly are in education, public education. There's a tremendous amount of misconception and confusion surrounding equality and excellence. The word excellence is used, it's referenced, but it's not meant. It's not really implemented. And in this planet, they do. They not only do
yeah.
that, but without losing sight of equality. So I think it's an amazing system in contrast to ours, our situation. And I think, again, it's educationally, in terms of pedagogy, curriculum, assessment, managing kids, very, very well grounded. And it gives kids a real purpose, not a theoretical purpose, a real actual purpose
mm-hmm.
and task. Wonderful.
So I wonder, you know, thinking out loud, you know, how it is that we are going to be able to move things to evolve in this direction in virtually any nation on earth. Any nation on earth that I can think of that values the degree of experiential education that is being talked about on government on a neighboring planet more than secondhand learning. We have promulgated the secondhand learning model, book learning, planet-wide. There's virtually no place on the planet aside from special educational institutions where people that are generally not fitting the regular mold are getting sent to either because it's the only kind of school that will work for them, on the one hand, or because their parents have special means in order to be able to send them to such a school that might have that kind of vision. But it's the exception and not the norm.
Well,
what can you see as possible first steps in moving either the schools of the United States, or I'm up here in Canada right now, and it's a very, very similar educational system to the United States. What can you see what can you see as being implemented as first steps toward a more experiential first-hand education?
I would just like to make one comment about that. I know Charles probably has some great insights about that question, Andre, but it just seems to me like in this nation, they really value each other. And when you really value, and maybe that is morality in a sense, when you really value somebody else or everybody else, every other citizen has tremendous value, and you want to make sure that they succeed. The success of the whole is tied up with the success of each individual, and each one is valued, and each one is given an equal opportunity to succeed, and each one is expected to take that opportunity. But again, that's all because their values are in the right place. And, you know, I think that until we as a world or as a nation or whatever get our values in the right place, we won't be able to achieve any of these things.
Hmm. Well, that's a little disheartening.
No, you know.
what do you think, Charles?
Well, I'm afraid my remarks may not please. I don't think they would please the majority in this society. I've had almost the entirety of my career in the public school system. Again, in three states: New York, Connecticut, and New Mexico. Principally, public high school students, 9 through 12, grades 9 through 12, et cetera, et cetera. So I've been in the belly of the beast for over two generations. I have taught. There's a reason for my preamble. I've taught dozens of kids whose parents I've taught. So I saw what happened, and to a certain degree. I mean, I saw the connections on many, many levels. And what I've observed is, this may be taken as overly harsh, but these are my thoughts, and you did raise the question. First of all, I think in this country, in the public school context, equality has been carried to a level of a superstition, philosophically and morally. Particularly in the intellectual sense, as a superstition. It's more delusion now than truth, equality. It's been, unfortunately, damaged. It's a damaged concept. And I first taught full-time in 1967, and I retired full-time, almost full-time in 2010, so that gives the people listening a sense of my range, in terms of chronology at least. I don't think the public school system can be reformed from within. Mm-hmm. It's too invested by a range of interests, confusions, misguided behavior, blighted and frustrated ideals, etc. So in my opinion, in the narrowest sense, the two reforms that I favor, one of them has been instituted in this country, but not nearly enough and not nearly sufficiently. It would be charter schools or something along those lines.
Yeah.
However, not the way charter schools that are unfettered. Their finances should be monitored very closely by the states, by the individual states. But the educational effort should be largely unfettered. And in New Mexico, it isn't. It's quite fettered. In other states, they're a little bit freer. But more importantly than charter schools, in my opinion, would be universal vouchers for parents. That's in the narrowest sense. Universal vouchers would empower parents in the true sense of the word, which is why the teacher unions fear them the most. They fear that more than merit pay, frankly, in my experiential observation. A universal parental voucher system would take the state monies that are allocated for each individual child and give the decision-making as to where that money will be spent to the parent. The parents don't actually get any money, of course, but they would make a choice, a school of their choice. This would cause, if this was implemented fully, it would cause pandemonium to a certain degree in the public schools that now exist, because many, many parents, beginning with middle-class parents, would withdraw their kids and put them in private schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to dominate talk too long. There are various problems with that, and I have opinions about that. For instance, what about religious private schools? In my opinion, if the state money was used by the parents, not the state, the state money is the people's money. I would remind our listeners, it's tax money, and it comes from the American people. It's the government is a custodian of it, but it's not their money; it's our money. And that we consent to be taxed and to be used. So if the money is if the buying power is transferred to the parents, it would empower parents, first of all, to make that decision. And if in case of a religious private school, I would argue that it doesn't violate church and separation of church and state because the parents are choosing, not the state. I would argue that. Others would disagree with me, of course. An ancillary but very important thought. Go back to what Paula just said. Parental universal vouchers, I think, would be a step in the right direction trying to reform and restructure the American family system, or to put that in modern terms, any modern society, because the family, the home life is suffering in many other societies, it would help to restructure and reform and strengthen somewhat more than it is the home life, because the parents would have... would be held responsible and would have the power with that responsibility, with a voucher system. And the pressure, this would put a downward, first bottom-upward, and then I think it would become lateral, and then it would become downward pressure on the public systems to reform themselves, because they would go out of business. They would have to close shut down. Certain high schools, for example, and elementary schools and middle schools would lose so many students, they have to shut them down or have drastic reductions. I think that would be a good thing. I think it is that corrupt. It's that. If I was to use one single word to criticize public education in this society, it'd be mediocrity. And mediocrity has become acceptable. It's been accepted.
Yeah. Does that go back to your comment about equality, Charles?
Yes, it would, but it has to be in the context of virtue.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of that statement that only by an increase in virtue can a republic survive and thrive.
Mm-hmm.
There is no other way. Public virtue and personal private virtue. Personal virtue and public virtue, whether it's privately or publicly demonstrated. And the parents who are not responsible, and I'm speaking on the basis of experience, direct experience, the parents who are not responsible, they're not responsible now, and they won't be responsible if this kind of action was taken. Now, these ideas have been promulgated; they've been largely rejected. And so, Andre, to answer your question, in a practical, political, moral step sense, I promote universal vouchers, parental vouchers, for the basic reason I've given. I have other support for that, but. And charter type school, both, and I think the two would overlap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's very, very interesting that you bring that up. I haven't said so on the air during this program, or probably for a long while. But I once, in a past life, I too was a teacher in a private school. I had a career for 14 years. And was in the classroom steadily for 12 or 13 of those years. And, so I've gotten to see a lot of education from that standpoint, and our school took a lot of the students that weren't making it in public schools, largely because of learning disabilities of various sorts. I also got to teach with individuals that were... very, very good teachers. I'll say many of them were much, much better teachers than myself. And with some Urantia book readers that were on staff as well. It was a quite a unique school, and still is quite a leader in education. And my thinking evolved along similar lines to yours, Charles. One of the possible solutions that I saw actually came from government on a neighboring planet in another quarter. You know, the idea that they don't always choose to do everything all at once. They're willing to implement solutions gradually, which has given me the viewpoint, you know, in a broader sense on this paper, that whereas we in our society tend to be more ideologically driven, that is, we're not as truth-oriented, we're not, you know, seeing what is ideal and practical and what can actually work, while they may not be fully to the level of being fully truth-oriented, what they definitely are, they do definitely seem to be a project management-oriented society, almost a Six Sigma society, if you will, where they really do look at root causes and best practices in order to try to ameliorate a situation. And so one of their solutions was, for instance, when they talk about the emancipation of slavery in their history, they did so gradually. They did so by emancipating the slaves 2% at a time. Well, you can imagine bringing that up in a political discussion in the United States, and what that might bring about, and how you might be viewed for even suggesting such an idea. But I bring that up because of the application of the idea to the situation of education. It occurred to me at one point with vouchers that what if you introduced a graduated voucher so that, yes, it might not be fully useful to all parents right away in that it was only 10% of the funds the first year. But what was implemented by law would be that over a period of 10 years, 10% more of the voucher would be available each succeeding year, so that educational systems would be able to be prepared, parents would be able to be prepared for a gradual increase in that political power in choosing their educational institutions, thereby not fully upsetting those systems and even giving some of those educational institutions the opportunity to better themselves in order to prepare for enhanced political clout of the parents in making those choices, and the possibility also for parents to educate themselves better in making those choices, because that's not a given either.
I want to point out something that was said on the board too, which I think has a lot of value. Ellen said that the voucher system sometimes could create a situation where people want things like creationism taught versus, you know, evolution or other, you know, more scientific concepts. And so, you know, the state of our religious beliefs would have an effect on the quality of an education that a child got. You know, I think one of the problems with education is that oftentimes we teach children what to think, not how to think.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I may speak to that,
sure,
parents,
ahead.
I think, have a certain prerogative. I've taught homeschool kids that were later sent to high school, and they were at a higher level of discipline of study than my average kid, public school kid. And if parents want, I mean, in homeschool, it's largely religiously sparked. It's also educationally sparked. They want both. They want more of God, and they want more of thinking and critical thinking and skills. Homeschool kids consistently win geography Bs and spelling Bs. The head of the NEA, one of the major national teaching unions, observe that's because they have more time for study. She said that in a press conference in New Jersey some years back. I don't think she realized the irony of that. I don't think the problem, the person who wrote that in does raise a legitimate concern, although my view of it is not as alarmed by that. We have a much greater problem, and we're not teaching people adequately even to read.
Right.
We're not teaching them to write very well. I taught history, but I was a history teacher who also taught thesis writing because English departments in the schools that I taught in were inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure my experience of getting kids in the ninth grade who couldn't write properly, who was typical is typical of the nation, frankly. I don't think it's untypical or unusual. I think there are pros and cons to what parents will choose. But if I was to cite one, the opposite, I cite the negative, was mediocrity. The thing that I lamented the most was a relative, comparative lack of a sense of excellence, real excellence, among students, parents, administrators, and teachers. I had thousands of lunches and conversations with teachers. Very rarely were ideas discussed. It was usually sports, movies, or some sensational event in the newspaper. That was a typical conversation. The majority of my colleagues in the schools that I've worked in, public schools that I've worked in, do not read in any serious sense. And do not have intellect, don't exhibit intellectual curiosity.
Well, there again, I think that that's gone down. Wouldn't you agree, Charles? I mean, I don't think that was true 50 or 100 years ago even. It seems to me like when you look at education, even in the United States 100 years ago, it was much more, based on, good basic skills, excellent basic skills. I mean, I look at the letters of soldiers in the Civil War as being absolutely works of art. They're beautiful. They're poetic.
People have remarked on that. The high schools 100 years ago, the first public high school was 1840. So the listeners have a historical perspective. It was in Connecticut, Middletown, Connecticut, by the way, first public high school. By 1910, maybe 20% of kids, I think it was about 20%, went to public high schools who were available to go. Mm-hmm. And by the 1930s and 40s and 50s, starting in the Depression onward to the 1960s, the comprehensive high school took hold. And the idea of public school was resisted in the 19th century for a long time. It was first articulated by Horace Mann in the 1820s and 30s. Mm-hmm. And it took 2 to 3 generations to convince the nation as a whole that public school, using taxpayer money, was a sound idea. It wasn't always a given as it is today, as thought of today. It's not an institution that, if institutions don't serve us, we should get rid of them in one form or another. I want to make one brief comment, Andre, in your suggestion about a graduated implementation of vouchers. I think that would be a step in the right direction. It's not the step I would take. The step I would take is I would pass it, if I had the power, I would pass it as legislation, and then I would announce it's going to be implemented 2 years from now. And I would advertise it. I would hope that governors, mayors, state legislators, I hope the media, activists would advertise it. Of course, that's assuming that the controversy would not be as great as I think it would be. But I would give people time, but then I would make it universal, and it would apply to all parents. And because I think force is needed, frankly. The one lamentation I have about public education is this lack of excellence, relative lack of excellence, real excellence. And I deplored it. It irritated me. It bothered me professionally, not personally, professionally. And it's lousy professionalism. And the government on a neighboring planet, that is this continental nation, I'd love to have a system I'd love to work in, because they value quality. They really do, and they reward it, and they reinforce it, and they structure it.
Right.
Yeah.
We could do the same. All the modern nations on Earth could do that. And even the ones that are less modern. There's nothing really stopping people except the will.
Well, and in some cases, some much more impoverished countries value an excellence of education more than we do. When that was my point about values. If we value each other, then we value the excellence of each other, and we will help each other to achieve excellence.
No, Paul, you're right. We don't really value children sufficiently in this society because they don't have utility. They're not productive. They don't generate wealth. I believe that's part of the reason. There's a moral side to that too. In my opinion, from what I can observe, there are not enough parents who value their own children. There aren't enough teachers that do. In society in general, where is the evidence that we as a society or other modern societies value children as individuals? Not as you hear people say, for example, well, they're our most important resource. Children are not resources. They're mm-hmm. they're sons and daughters of God. They're cosmic citizens. They're persons. They're persons.
Yeah.
They're personal. They're not resources. Oil is a resource. Lumber is a resource. Gold is a resource. Children are not resources. I understand how they mean that, but it's again, it's an example of how we don't value children. You're right, Paula. Until that comes about, you'll see no change in public education for real, in my opinion. In the governing plan, if I was to take Section 4 and paraphrase it and then present it to a school board, they would look at me blind, deaf, and dumb. I have some experience at that, at presenting certain ideas. It's not valued. It's not that they don't understand intellectually. It's not valued.
Mm-hmm.
It's thought of.
That's a very good point, and frankly, I do think it is also hard for people to envision it, and it's hard for us, having had the Urantia book for as many years as we've had it, or even for a few years. How much transformation, what an educational experience having the Urantia book is, in terms of how mm-hmm. eye-opening that is to what the possibilities are. So, I mean, some of what that brings to mind for me, and in resonance with your thought, Charles, is, I mean, consider the fact that, you know, in our spiritual education, you know, we go along in classes and we move along through the super universe, but when we get to Havona, and even long before Havona, we know that our educational path is individualized, that our personality is honored all the way up, no matter whether we're with others or not. But when we get to Havona, they take us through Havona one at a time. We're assigned a graduate
right.
guide. We literally do not go along with anyone else but ourselves. And why is that? Because God himself knows that we each have an individual path to walk through Havona and through those billion spheres. Can you imagine the love and the care in a regime that decides to pilot us through one by one and devotes the resources to do that? Our own individual teachers, a graduate guide, all of that, for literally a billion spheres, billions of years, you can imagine. So now, taking that highfalutin idea, that ideal presented in the Urantia book, and projecting it back down onto our situation, I agree with you, Charles, that we should at least be able to see the value in individual personalities, be able to recognize these as children of God to the extent that each is going to have a unique gift, not only to give to the world, but that our society has a unique gift to give to each of them in developing who they are individually.
And you know what's interesting is we haven't gotten beyond just this one section on education, but how perfect that we had Charles to talk to. How perfect that we had Charles to talk to about this, because he truly is an expert on it, and having a tremendous amount of experience and historical perspective on it. And I just appreciate that so much, Charles. And you know, I think we could spend a whole show on each one of these sections, actually, if we really thought about it.
Thank you, Paul.
Charles, we can't thank you enough. I thank you as well. It's wonderful, wonderful being in personal contact with you, even over the air like this. Appreciate your thoughts and your contribution.
You're a good friend.
You're very articulate and thoughtful way
thank
of
you.
Communicating. It's
likewise.
So deeply appreciated, Charles. Thank you so much.
I guess we're nearly done. May I say a prayer?
Yes, please.
Closing prayer, is that?
Yes. Absolutely.
Please, why not?
I just thought of it a minute ago. Heavenly Father, beloved, Heavenly Father, hallowed be your name, and hallowed be the name of your divine Son, Michael of Nebadon. Thank you both. Father, thank you for your grace. May your grace help us down here, all of us, to seek more wisdom, your insights, your perspective. May your grace help us to listen to each other better. If not perfectly, at least better. May we have more patience. May we listen more intelligently. May we become more receptive in your grace, broadly speaking, in our lives, in our relationships. This gift, this Urantia book, this noble and grand fifth epical revelation, this marvelous and wonderful gift that's been bestowed upon our world, may we study it and learn from it and live to the best of our ability what it teaches. Help us to learn and preserve and perpetuate it and its grand teachings contained therein. Help us to live now as if light, at least in our personal lives, in our relationships as students of this book, as readers of this book, at least as if light and life is already here. To live the way you did, Jesus, when you told your ambassadors, your apostles, that you're held to a heavenly standard, a higher standard. Help us through your grace, Michael and Father, to remember that and to take it seriously and to heart. But help us also, Master, to have your sense of humor, and yours too, Father, for I believe you have one. Thank you again, Father. You will, through your divine Son, who has made this possible for us, you will be the source. You will remain the source and center of light and life for us for an eternity. And we're grateful. And we appreciate it. Amen.
Amen.
And so may it be. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm the one who's grateful. And I want to say
that makes three of us.
I insist.
One of the frustrations I had was most of my colleagues in all the years and places I've taught were never very interested in the history of their own profession and education. That used to frustrate me. So for me, it's a golden opportunity to be able to share the perspective of some of what I know about our education, and particularly in relation to this wonderful section and this wonderful paper in our marvelous book. So I'm very grateful on that too.
Me too.
Well, likewise. Well, thank you so much again, Charles, for making this a wonderful show, and thank you, Paula, of course, for hosting, and I guess we need to say goodbye to all our cosmic citizens.
Yeah, goodbye for now, but we'll be back next week.
Sounds
again.
Good.
All right.
Adios.
Adios.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.